Okay, we finished with Bordetella, so let's just review Bordetella pertussis. These are gram-negative rods, toxoid looking. That's what the gram stain looks like. They're not cyclophosphine, not filling, it's just toxoid. Occasionally you see bipolar staining, which means they stain darker on either end or both ends, but you don't always see that. And the disease state is pertussis, which we know commonly as whooping cough. Okay, we use the nasopharyngeal swab as the best type of sample. Okay? Like I said before, we often get swabs instead of nasopharyngeals, but we don't often get requests for Bordetella because of the vaccinations that people have had. So the doc has to suspect, an index of suspicion, that the patient has whooping cough, and let the lab know that, because the lab is not going to have this media on hand.
My pediatrician said that there's been recent more Resurgence. Cases of pertussis, and he said it had to do with, like, parents, like, because he hasn't gotten his yet, you know, it's not, you can't get it yet, but, like, the parent hasn't had a booster, like, so now they started putting the pertussis in with the tetanus booster because you lose your immunity, so then the parent would get it and then go to their
and give it to the child, yeah.
And so that's been...
And some people don't like the idea of giving vaccines to their infants,
they
so they don't get the vaccines.
Yeah.
So for that reason, it's still around a little bit, and again, of course, because of the international travel we have, but... The Bordet-Janjou media. And what that is potato glycerol blood. And I don't know how they come up with these combinations, but that's what it is. So that's why we don't have it on hand, because we don't use it for anything else. So the doc needs to let us know so that we can order that. Incubate 37 degrees. Sometimes it takes up to 7 days to see growth, so it doesn't grow as rapidly as staph or strep. Breathe plates daily. And when you do see growth, they appear as these pearl drop colonies. So like little droplets of mercury on the dark media. So that would be suspected Bordetella species. Yeah, we're not going to worry about these species here. We're just going to talk about Bordetella pertussis. So there are some things you can do to differentiate. But commonly what they will do if they have a suspected Bordetella is confirmed with fluorescent tests or antiserum. So the diagnostic immunologic tests can be used for this one to speed up the diagnosis as it takes longer to grow it.
So it grows on blood auger?
Yes, it will grow on blood auger, but it grows better on the special media. Bordet-Janjou. Okay, so here's the nasopharyngeal swab again. And the ideal thing is to take two swabs, collect two swabs, and culture one, and then put the other one, in saline or other broth, and make smears, and then do a direct fluorescent antibody examination. So what we're doing with direct fluorescent, we're trying to find the unknown antigen, see if the patient has the organism using the antibodies. So that would speed up the diagnosis. We're much greater than waiting a week or so for the organism to grow. Okay, let's move on. We do have some host defense mechanisms.
Are there any serological tests for Bordetella?
Well, just a direct fluorescent antibody. That's a serological test.
Okay, so you could do that one instead of...
You could. Depends on the hospital's protocol. But probably it's best to do both. Because if you've got the organism growing and you can see it, it's much better. Have that on hand as well. Okay, we do have some host defense mechanisms against getting upper respiratory tract infections. Nasal hairs in the nasal passage and mucus production, and both of those are helpful for trapping organisms because we inhale them, we breathe them in through the nasal passages, and we can trap them. And then we've got cilia. What are cilia? Those little hair-like projections that propel organisms outward. And that's particularly helpful for lower respiratory tract diseases, which we'll talk about next week. And then we have the coughing and sneezing mechanisms, which are good for the person coughing and sneezing, but not so good for the person on the other end. Okay, here's a regular sneeze. So you can see these aerosol, and these can travel quite a ways. This is a head cold sneeze. But all these little droplets has got organisms on there.
It's all nuts.
This is a stifled sneeze, but you can still see organisms. Oh, look, there's a face mask.
Wow.
This is a cough, so you can still see aerosols, so they're not as much as sneeze. And, any guess what this one is?
Talking.
Talking. This is enunciation of the letter F, as in
F.
Fun to study language.
Yeah.
So you probably get that a lot of you too, but just a simple talking.
You're sick yet? You're
sick. Get aerosols. Just be careful. What you're doing, especially if you're sick. Okay, now the organisms have means of counteracting our host defense mechanisms, because in order to cause disease, they have to get inside and they have to colonize so that they can reproduce and do whatever they do. So this is just a brief summary of some of the pathogenic mechanisms that organisms have. They have adherence factors. One of these, particularly in strep, strep produces a substance called M-protein, and this is found in the cell wall, gram-positive cell wall structure. And that M-protein facilitates the organism binding to cells where it can cause infection. Others have fimbriae. What are fimbriae? Yeah, those little things too. But those are on the organism instead of the host. And this will be particularly important a little bit later when we talk about urinary tract infections, fimbriae. Some organisms cause the disease by producing toxins. So it's not the organism itself colonizing, but the toxins they produce. And we'll take a look at these in Carinibacterium diphtheriae and Bordetella pertussis. Some enzymes are produced, enzymes which enable the organism, well, it destroys some of the tissues, the host tissues, so it enables the organism to spread throughout the tissues and get to the sites where it can cause disease. Some disease symptoms are caused by immune-mediated tissue damage, so it's actually the immune system that's causing the symptoms, and we'll see an example of that. And then many of them have evasion factors, which enable them to evade our immune system, like capsules. Neisseria and Haemophilus, two that we've studied this week, fall in that category. They both have capsules. And so they are more difficult to phagocytize. And that's one reason why they do cause infections in children more readily, or infants, because infants don't really have sufficient antibodies and phagocytic mechanisms initially to fight them off. Others are intracellular parasites, and that applies particularly to viruses and other organisms that invade the cell. That's the main evasion factor of viruses. So they get inside the cell, and the immune system can't fight it. Okay, routes of entry and exit, aerosols, as we've seen, and secretions. So droplets of stuff on the tabletop or the doorknob or something, so that's why you need to wash your hands frequently. So it comes out the same way as we get infected. Okay, let's go into diseases. This is pharyngitis. Pharyngitis is just a fancy name for what?
Sore throat.
Sore throat. It doesn't have to be strep throat, but just any kind of sore throat, because there's a lot of different organisms that can cause a sore throat that mimic strep throat. But you can see how beaten red the throat is. That looks pretty sore. Occasionally you see these little white patches. So these are the areas where you need to swab if you're doing the throat swab, back here by the uvula. And if you see patches, swab the white patches. Okay, so this one that we're talking about, particularly here, is strep pyogenes, which causes the beta strep or the strep throat. Now, nobody ever died from a strep throat. But the problem with the strep throat, particularly in children, is the complications that can occur. They can develop rheumatic fever or acute glomerulonephritis. So that's why it's important to take children to the doc and get diagnosed, usually between the ages of 5 to 14 is when it's most common in children, but of course it can occur earlier. Get it diagnosed, because if it is strep, then we want to put them on antibiotic to prevent the occurrence of these. Now, these don't occur very frequently. Maybe up to 5% of patients that have strep throat, strep pyogenes, can develop these. But if they do develop them, it can be a serious consequence.
Can't it, like, migrate? Because it happened to my aunt where she had strep throat and her daughter had strep throat, but it traveled. like to different areas of the body. And, I mean, she has lupus, but I guess it can happen.
So they isolated it from different samples? Uh-huh. It's possible, sure. You can get strep in blood. Blood cultures, if it gets in the blood, it can travel anywhere. So it's not just contained to the respiratory tract. Okay, let's describe what these symptoms or these complications are. Okay, this just shows, pretty much ignore all that stuff. Down here, and it got cut off, but this is acute rheumatic fever, or acute rheumatic heart disease, so it affects the heart. And this is glomerulonephritis, which affects the kidneys. So those are the two complications. Now what happens in acute rheumatic fever, you probably learned this in your immunology class, is the body develops antibodies to the strep organism, like it should, but those antibodies cross-react with tissues on the heart, particularly the mitral valve of the heart. So there are some tissue receptors on that mitral valve of the heart that are very similar to the antigen on the strep. So the antibody not only binds to strep to lead to its destruction, but it binds to the tissue and activates the antigen-antibody complex, activates complement, and begins destroying the mitral valve. And that's rheumatic heart disease. Then it can affect other organs. And the person can have a lifelong infection from that. In fact, there have been people in their 40s, 50s that die because of a pre-existing condition of rheumatic heart fever. They have heart failure at an early age. So if we get it diagnosed and treated, then we prevent the development of that. Acute glomerulonephritis is an infection of the glomerulus of the kidney. And that, again, up to 5% of patients can develop that, and it causes acute glomerulonephritis, which usually doesn't lead to any long-term consequences. It usually is resolved and heals itself, and the patient doesn't suffer from it. But I have seen cases where a child somewhere between their age 5 to 14 had strep, developed acute glomerulonephritis from that, which went on to lead to kidney failure, and actually had to have kidney transplant. So I mean, those cases are very rare, but you can see the possibilities of what might happen. So that's why we get it treated, not just because of the strep throat, but because of the complications. Okay, scarlet fever is caused by strep pyogenes, but it's a certain strain, it's a little different strain of pyogenes. It's one that produces erythrogenic toxin. So the regular strep that we get with the strep throat does not produce that toxin. And the way it gets the toxin is the organism has to first be lysogenized. Do you remember learning about lysogeny? Who says yes? What's lysogeny?
Well, it's like the little lysosome in the cell, isn't it? The bacteria gets lyse, and then that releases the
green cell.
A little bit different.
Okay.
Lysogeny is when the virus infects the bacteria. And the virus actually carries the gene for the codes for the toxin. And so that then, the virus then conveys that gene to the organism, to the bacteria. So when the bacteria continue to multiply and divide, their progeny then now have the gene to produce the toxin. So unless the strain of strep has been lysogenized or infected by the virus, it doesn't have the genes, so it doesn't produce the toxin. So that's the difference. So one of the classic symptoms of scarlet fever, of course, is a fever, but you get this red rash all over the body. And this used to be quite common in pioneer days and even upward from that. We used to have, well, I remember my, I had an older sister when I was a child. She had scarlet fever. But we don't see as much of it anymore. Here's one of the other symptoms of scarlet fever. The tongue can get this white patchy growth on it, which is probably some part of the organism, part necrotic tissue, just dead tissue, and accumulation of the bacteria, fibrin, those things. And then that desquamates or sheds, and you end up with the red strawberry tongue, the beefy red tongue. And that's what I always think about when I go to the grocery store. I see strawberries. Scarlet fever. Okay.
That's how you know if you get a good strawberry.
Yep. Okay, let's talk about diphtheria. And remember, the word is pronounced diphtheria, not diphtheria, like so many unknowledgeable people. I just happened to be looking at you. Diphtheria, okay, caused by Varanobacterium diphtheriae. Okay, this one produces a toxin, exotoxin. Okay, so we become infected by airborne transmission. So these are, again, upper respiratory, so aerosols. Inhale it through the nasal passages. And then the organism just colonizes right here at the back of the throat. It doesn't move, it's not mobile, doesn't spread to other parts of the body. But there are a couple characteristics of diphtheria. One is the formation of what's called a pseudomembrane, and the other is a bold net. Okay, I'll show you examples of these. The organism, as it colonizes here, it just causes necrosis of the tissue right here. And it traps the organism, it traps white blood cells, it traps fibrin, maybe red blood cells in there. And it begins to form this pseudomembrane, which eventually turns out to be like a tough, leathery substance. Initially it starts out as kind of soft, and then it develops into a tough, leathery substance. And it can extend upward into the nasal passages, but more importantly, it can extend downward and close off the opening to the trachea, which is the air passage. So the patient can suffocate, and that's one of the causes of death in diphtheria, suffocation, as this pseudomembrane closes off that airway. Okay, it causes enlargement of lymph nodes in the neck, leading to a swollen neck, and that's what we call a bull neck. I'll show a picture of that. And then it produces this toxin. So the toxin then is produced by the organism right here. It gets into the blood and it spreads to major organs, particularly nervous system, heart, kidneys, and destroys those or damages those. And that's also what causes a lot of the death in diphtheria, is the toxin production. Okay, so let's take a look at, here's the pseudomembrane. You can actually see it in the back of the throat. And in the beginning stages, it's kind of soft and pliable, and you can take a Kim wipe or something and actually kind of remove it. You get a little bit of bleeding, but after it develops, it adheres very tightly, and you can't get it out unless you cut it. And if you cut it, you're going to cause a lot of bleeding, so that's not a good thing to do. Okay, this is the bull neck, so you can see the swelling of the lymph nodes in the neck area. Okay, so how do we diagnose Corynebacterium diphtheriae in the laboratory, the organism? How do we identify it, I should say? I've got a $100 bill in my pocket for the first person. Oh, times 100.
Wow, that was quick.
What else?
Blood cells?
No, the blood cells in the lymphocytes. Don't they turn into blood cells when you have... Oh, never mind.
I'm trying to think. What did I say?
No, nothing. I thought we were still on whooping cough.
Oh, okay. Well...
We played it on SBA.
Okay, you got your notes. You can cheat. Okay, what other media do we play it on? Not your regular one, but the special one where we have to do a stain? Leffler's. Leffler's stain medium. Okay, what kind of stain do we do from that?
Methylene blue.
Methylene blue, what do we look for? See? You guys can't possibly learn all this stuff if you leave us till Monday night. Forget hematology for a while. Okay, we look for metachromatic granules, which is the large granule, large dark staining areas in the organism. Okay, then what else do we have to do to diagnose diphtheria, Corynebacterium? Yeah, I guess I can't give away my $100 bill today. I don't think I have one, do you? It has to be a toxin-producing Right. Elick, or Elick, I want to pronounce it. You need an infusion test. Which tests for the toxin. See if there's a toxin producing organ. Okay, so remember that. So in order to treat diphtheria, we treat it with antibiotics, which destroys the organism, but we also have to treat it with an antitoxin, which destroys the toxin. So just treating with antibiotics alone is not sufficient. Do you all know the story of the, you know, the Iditarod race is?
Yeah,
that's the Iditarod. That's the Alaskan sled dog race. It started back in 1923 when there was an outbreak of diphtheria in Nome, Alaska, a little tiny village up in Nome, Alaska that was pretty isolated during the winter months. The only way they could get to it from Anchorage to Nome was by dog sled. And they had an outbreak of diphtheria. The doc recognized it, so he had to send for, get some antitoxin pretty quick because all the kids were coming down with diphtheria and dying. So they had to race the antitoxin to Nome on dog sleds. And that was kind of the beginning of the Iditarod dog sled race. There's a book out that I read called The Cruelest Miles that describes this outbreak and what those mushers, the dog sled racers, went through to get that antitoxin there. That's quite an interesting story. Okay, now, otitis media. What is that? Otitis media. Middle ear infection. Okay. What happens is the infection occurs right here behind the eardrum. And it puts pressure, as pus builds up, puts pressure on the eardrum, and that causes tremendous pain. And this usually occurs, it usually starts in children about 6 months of age, after mom's antibodies, maternal antibodies, have started to decline, and baby's trying to build up its own antibodies, but doesn't, so it doesn't have a purely effective immune system at that point, 4 to 6 months. So that's when it first occurs, but of course it can occur in older children as well, but very painful with that pressure behind the eardrum. So where does the infection come from? Well, this is what we call an endogenous infection. What does endogenous mean?
The bacteria already there.
Right. It's not a communicable disease. We don't get otitis media from somebody else. It's not transmissible. So, here's our nasopharynx, back of the throat, the nasal passages, the organisms that are inhabiting this area, which can be normal flora, or the patient can have a previous upper respiratory tract infection with the organisms there, they travel along the Eustachian tube. I pointed out earlier that the Eustachian tube is just a little tiny tube that connects the nasal area, nasal behind the nose and throat, to the ear. So that's where these organisms get into the middle ear and cause infections that come from the nasopharynx. So it's the patient's own organism, either normal flora or if they've had a previous infection. That's what endogenous means. Now, there are several agents that can cause this, and these are certainly not all of them, but the top two are Strep pneumoniae and Haemophilus influenzae. Need to know. Need to know. Strep pneumoniae, Haemophilus influenzae. Okay, we haven't talked about Strep pneumoniae yet. We'll talk about that next week. Moraxella catarrhalis, Pyogenes, anaerobes even can cause it. So there's several agents that can cause that infection. Okay. Yes.
So, sorry. Going back to that last slide. So, when doctors put tubes in their ears, how does that stop the infection as it goes up the?
The tube helps to drain the fluid that accumulates here. Because as you get an infection, you get inflammation, you get fluid accumulation, you get pus, and if it stays there and doesn't drain, then that puts pressure on the eardrum. In fact, it can even puncture the eardrum, leading to hearing loss.
So the kids with three sets of tubes.
We've had it three times?
Yeah.
Same kid?
Yeah.
Where does the tube go?
In the ear.
Somebody else have a question?
He said, okay. Where does the tube go? Okay. So it goes like...
So the tube goes in the ear, and then what? Then it drains?
You can actually, if you pull the ear back, you can actually look in and see the tube. Yeah. So it just opens that passageway up right there, and it's a little plastic blue tube.
So it opens up. Does it drain back down the Eustachian tube?
Both.
Yeah. So and they keep it in there ways. For how long?
They just keep it in there until it falls out.
Until it falls out, yeah.
I remember getting a lot of ear infections and not getting a lot of like cultures done or anything.
No, they never culture.
They just look in there and be like,
They can tell. They can look in here and they can tell if that's red and inflamed.
In fact, my wife had a little otoscope. She would look and call the doctor.
Because it happens so frequently with your kids.
So we won't really deal with a lot of...
You probably won't get a lot
ear of... Cultures.
Ear cultures. In older people, and I have never had an ear infection, so I don't really know what it's like, but I've seen my little nephew with one when he was about 6 months. So just cry, because it's so painful. There's nothing you can do. Yeah, they pull on their ears. So we won't see many cultures for that because they can usually tell. But those knowing what the most common organisms are that cause it, they can treat it based on that knowledge. Okay, sinusitis is infection of the sinuses. So we've got several sinuses up in our nasal passages and around up somewhere up in the head. If any of you have ever had sinus infection, you know that typically leads to a very severe headache as well because of the pressure that builds up in the sinuses and they can't drain.
Can this ear infection be caused because of cold temperatures? Because I felt like it was much more frequent in Russia compared to here.
Was it?
Yeah.
Not that I know of, unless sometime in winter months, people or children have more infections, upper respiratory tract infections, colds and things like that.
So probably because of that.
So because of that, they could travel to the ear.
Do you know why in colder months there are
Well. The upper respiratory tract is a nice, warm, humid environment for the organism. But also, sometimes it's not as humid as we would like it to be because there's a lot of dry air. It depends upon where you live, there's a lot of dry air, and the nasal passages might dry up a little bit. And then it's a little easier for the organisms to adhere as well. Those are the only things, only reasons that I know. And, well, and then another one is because people are indoors more in the wintertime. So it's easier for these infections to spread, the upper respiratory tract infections to spread from person to person, particularly in children in daycare or schools. And then it gets colonized.
I think it might be because, like, we have ceilings in our houses, so it stops moving in the cold weather. Perhaps there isn't any much clearing.
That could be another reason too. Yeah.
This is I heard this from my immunology professor or something, that he said that rhinovirus, it sees in your nose, which doesn't matter. Sometimes if it gets colder, that's its like optimal environment. So if it cold more like that. Is that true?
If the immunology professor said it, it must be true. Okay, so what do you recognize about these two? Streptomyces, Haemophilus influenzae.
The same
top two organisms that cause otitis media cause sinusitis. So it should be easy to remember then, right? What causes sinusitis? Okay, acute epiglottitis. Not a very common condition, and usually only occurs in children. But what happens is, right here, if we look at the anatomy again, there's a little flap of tissue called the epiglottis. And when we eat something and swallow, we want our food to go down the Eustachian tube. Or, sure.
Yeah.
down the esophagus.
Wow, that would hurt.
Yeah. You can see all that coming out. Okay, down the esophagus, which goes to the digestive tract. Okay, we don't want it to go down the trachea, which is the air passage. What happens if it does go down there?
Heimlich.
Yeah. So what happens is this little flap of tissue, the epiglottis, closes off, just folds over and closes off the trachea while we are swallowing, so that the food goes down the esophagus. And then, after we swallow it, it opens up. So you can't breathe and swallow at the same time.
You can try.
So, in acute epiglottitis, the agent is Haemophilus influenzae. And what it does, for some reason, it colonizes the epiglottis. And it causes it to be inflamed and enlarged. And so it just closes off the trachea by itself. And this is a very scary disease in children because it can lead to suffocation or death within 24 hours. So if there's symptoms like that, not being able to breathe, that needs to be treated immediately because that's a very serious infection. So here's I wonder about the slide. It looks like the Grim Reaper or something. Looks pretty scary, doesn't it?
You did that.
But this is one of the things that they can do with a child with acute blepharitis is put them against this board and hold their head back so that tends to open up the air passage a little bit. Or in severe cases, they can do a tracheotomy. Just slip the throat there and allow the rest to clear. Probably a little musical accompaniment helps. Okay, whooping cough. Again, Bordetella pertussis, and it's the toxin that causes the disease. So, the whooping cough is more of a chronic disease. It can last 1 to 2 months. It can last even longer than that, depending upon how severe it is and the age of the patient and everything. But the patient starts out coughing. Well, it starts out as just kind of a mild upper respiratory tract infection, not really knowing that it's whooping cough at that stage. And then it develops into more of the distinctive symptomatic cough, very hard coughing. They can cough hard enough to actually break a rib, cough that much. And that's because the organism does destroy a lot of cilia in the throat. And so they have to cough very hard to get it. It leads to a lot of mucus formation to get that stuff up.
I'm going to preface this by saying it's a ridiculous question, but if you hung upside down, would that fix it? Could you hang upside down and just be okay?
It's like grabbing tickets.
It's like
a stroke.
Yeah, you'd have more complications from that than when he was coughing.
I was just curious.
So they cough, they cough upwards of 10 to 15 times. And then they eventually have to breathe, so they stop to inhale, and that's where the whooping sound comes from. As they inhale the air, and then they continue to cough again. So that's kind of the pathway of whooping cough. So it needs to be treated with an antibiotic. Anybody ever had this infection? You know what this is. You don't want this. This is virus. I didn't have a picture. This is the common cold. How do you show a picture of a person with a cold? But this is what you kind of feel like, isn't it? Maybe you feel like this. I don't know. For sure, it's more lower.
Yeah.
But your head becomes just swollen and inflamed, and it just feels like it's that big when you've got a cold. So, but the point is that over 70% of upper respiratory tract infections are caused by viruses, not strep pneumonias, Staph aureus, or of course some of them are, but the majority of them are viruses, and there's nothing we can do about it. So antibiotics won't work. We can take some cold medicine or something that might, some antihistamines that might temporarily relieve some of the congestion and symptoms, but it pretty much has to run its course.
NyQuil
helps sleep at night a little bit, yeah. So just remember that, and that's why doctors overprescribe, because they give the patients are sick enough to go to the doc, they want some relief, they want a prescription. So the docs will give a prescription, which doesn't help if it's virus, and that just leads to more and more antibiotic resistance.
Yep.
No more silly questions. let's do a case study. Okay. Based on what you know, let's see if we can resolve this case. Okay, a 4-year-old child with a history of allergies and frequent upper respiratory infections was seen for nasal congestion and flu-like symptoms. The initial onset of fever, diarrhea, and vomiting was followed 24 hours later by upper respiratory congestion with a green purulent nasal discharge. What's purulent?
Pus-like.
The infection appeared to be a localized sinusitis with no evidence of bronchitis or pneumonia. Culture was done on the nasal discharge, and the patient began receiving oral amoxicillin. The CBC was done with the following results. Ah, CBC. We all know that. What's normal here? White cells are a little bit high. Okay. Which would be typical of an infection, right? Okay, the child's symptoms persisted, and the following day he was even more lethargic and had become hoarse. A redness had developed around one eye. Isophagic?
Tired.
Did you get isophagic today? Okay, questions. What media should be played with? The sample that we received in the lab. What do you want to play?
SPA.
And?
Chocolate.
Chocolate.
Anything
else? MTM. MTM. Okay. Most labs will do just an SPA and a chocolate. Okay, I put the MTM in parentheses because we did that this week, but the reason we did that is because we were dealing with Neisseria and I wanted to give you a better chance to isolate the Neisseria and to incorporate this medium into how it works. But most labs are not going to do that because the organisms that would generally cause these upper respiratory infections will grow either on blood or chocolate. You should be able to isolate on either one of those. Okay, is the initial Gram stain helpful on the sample?
No. You might have different
organisms.
If it's a predominant organism.
Usually it's not helpful because you can't distinguish the normal flora from the pathogens. So you've got a lot of normal flora, gram-positive cocci, gram-negative rods. Bill mentioned that this predominant organism might be helpful, but usually we're going to look for predominant organism on the growth on the plate.
So they're going to do a Gram stain, though.
Depends, again, on the hospital protocol.
Yeah.
So some hospitals might still say, look, we're going to do the Gram stain, and others will say, don't waste your time. Okay, what do you want to know next? Growth characteristics. Good. Bill's almost ready to get the $100 bill.
Okay.
Okay, this is what it looked like on chocolate. What do you see? There's two different colonies at least on there. Okay, but they're kind of grayish, opaque. Pretty good size. Okay, so there was no growth on SPA. And let me see, what else did we do? I can't remember what else. Oh, I'm sorry, there was growth on SPA in chocolate, but no growth on MTM.
Oh.
Is that a clue?
Really.
Okay, now, what do you want to know next?
Gram
stain. Don't you wish it was this easy? Where's your gram stain? Okay.
What color is that?
Those are gram negatives. Question. Are you, you have questions?
Sorry, no. Just stretching.
Don't do that. Okay, what are possible pathogens based on the colony characteristics, based on the Gram stain? Does this look like Gram negative rods?
No.
No.
Cocci, okay. Possible pathogens. Would be Haemophilus, these are not Gram negative rods.
No,
it's
wrong.
Yeah. Maybe this didn't want to. Based on the Gram stain, it could be Neisseria, or could it be Waxella, Donamella. Okay, let's see. What further testing should be done? Is it oxidase?
Catalase.
What's the oxidase reaction? See how easy that was? Catalase.
Now what? Sugars. Good. Which sugars are we going to do? All negative.
What color should they be?
Yellow.
If they're positive. Okay, so CK sugars are all negative. What's the pathogen?
More XL
Camarellus, right. Okay, so what if, let's go back here, what if both of these tubes, glucose and maltose, were positive?
Same
juice. What if all three were positive?
What
if only glucose is positive?
Okay,
so you missed it. Good.
Because of your
trick. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that up all by myself.
Oh my God.
I deserve the $100.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah.
Okay, what's the significance of this organism, Waxella catarrhalis? is it always a pathogen? Is it normal flora? Or
it's always a
pathogen. Remember about it.
It's normal flora.
It's usually normal flora. However, sometimes it could be an opportunistic pathogen, and we can see it causing sinus infections. The letters that are listed on there. So we can't just automatically disregard it as normal flora, particularly in a case like this when we don't find any other pathogens. And so we would also look at the quantities of both, if that's the primary organism.
What diagnostic is like, for example, like you said, is it a color discharge? So is like the color ever diagnostic? Is like, okay, like these organisms definitely produce.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I have this.
You have more XO?
It was bronchitis.
Oh, and that's on our list too, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. The stuff I was feeling was great. Yeah. But I'm saying that it was all.
All that. Yeah, okay. So in that case, if that's all you saw, then perhaps a gram stain would be helpful. But it still wouldn't tell us exactly what the organism was.
Right.
Is that what you had over Christmas?
No, that was you.
Yes.
So for unknowns this week, do we have. It could be either Neisseria or Gemeralis, right? Because, like, if you have...
Or Homobolus.
Okay, if you have growth on the MTM, like...
Oh, so if you have growth on the MTM, it's not going to be Homobolus. It's not going to be Marcella. So what's MTM for?
Neisseria.
Particularly pathogenic Neisseria. Okay, with one exception. Which Neisseria grows on MTM that is not a pathogen? Okay, but Moraxella will not grow on here. Okay, so that's a clue. So it was not Neisseria. Because we figured that out initially because it didn't grow on MTM. But just from the gram stain, gram negative bifococci. Okay, let's see what else we have here. The antibiotic of choice is erythromycin. So what did they give the patient in the beginning? Amoxicillin, okay, and the next day he was worse. So amoxicillin was not a good antibiotic for this organism because it produces beta-lactamase. Remember what beta-lactamase is?
It breaks
the beta-lactamase of the penicillins and the family. So amoxicillin was not working.
Yeah.
The organism was resistant to that. So they switched the antibiotic to erythromycin and the patient recovered. Okay, what are the most common pathogens of sinusitis?
Homophilus
influenzae.
Okay. Case resolved.
Yeah, that's right.
Thanks.